Welcome everyone to another day at the Damage Report. I am John Iadarola, joined in studio today by Brett Ehrlich, host of both Pop Trigger and the Happy Half Hour, which will be another episode will be available tomorrow, actually.
I swallowed wrong.
He swallowed wrong. So this is the sort of preparation you can expect out of every episode of the Happy Half Hour. So I'm going to keep it real with you. We have got a gigantic show today. We're going to be starting off with a story I wanted to get to yesterday, and that is Elizabeth Warren's anti-corruption bill that is just amazing. And the more that I read about it, the more excited I become about the possibilities that this sort of bill could eventually become law once we have government that's a little bit more responsive to what the actual people want. We're going to be talking about the latest from Donald Trump's interviews on the show of record, Fox and Friends. And perhaps more importantly than all that, we have two returning guests to the Damage Report today. We have journalist David K. Johnston, who's going to be talking about what can be done at the state level to hold President Trump accountable that might not be possible at the federal level. And we'll be rejoined by a journalist and an author, Lori Penny, who was on the program earlier this week, for a part two on her analysis of the Jordan Peterson male improvement, I guess, philosophy and series of books and videos. So we'll be talking about her with that as well.
Yeah,
I swallowed wrong too. Anyway,
I just got over my swallowing wrong. Those are two of my favorite guests.
They're just
thoroughly
awesome.
Delightful people.
Yes, a lot of people get described as a delight. They're delights.
They're utterly delightful.
That said, we have a couple of things we want to talk about before we get to the Elizabeth Warren story. So I just briefly wanted to update you on, we had Amar Campanajar, Democratic congressional candidate in the 50th District of California. He was on the program yesterday, and he's running against Duncan Hunter, who has been indicted multiple counts of misusing campaign funds. His wife is indicted as well. They were using this money to buy shorts and steaks and plane tickets for rabbits.
Golf balls that they wanted to expense, or something at a pro shop that they wanted to expense as golf balls for veterans.
Yes, even though they were not. And he's a veteran, so it almost makes it more sick that he was using vets to cover up some of his corruption. Anyway, so you might be thinking, this is out there now. What will happen? What will become of him? Will he feel shame for the corruption that is now well documented? No, if we bring this up, Duncan Hunter says that the Democrats and the deep state are behind those indictments and that he will not be resigning. He was reached for comment while filming a James Bond movie.
He really does.
But anyway, yeah, he's a former vet. He's obviously in good shape or whatever. He's also corrupt though. The Democrats are not behind it. The deep state is not behind it. Like, they've got the receipts. They've got the financial information. He did this. What he is doing, that headline that you saw there, the quote that they got from him, all that is a product of the time that we live in right now, where you used to feel some shame or accountability for the things that you did as a politician if it was revealed in as clear a way as this was. That is gone now. Now you just wait and see.
Yes.
And maybe if you pulled your pants down, maybe you might still get out of office. But that's really about it at this point.
It was all about pressure to do things, pressure to step down, pressure to feel some shame. And there is someone called the bluff on pressure, and that person was Donald Trump. And that was it. And people have done that in the past. There's been a lot of gaffes where people, you know, you kind of roll the dice on whether they step down or not. Mm-hmm. And usually it was like personal dalliances and indiscretions. Like if you walk the Appalachian Trail, you can make it through, you know. Mm-hmm. Instead of sleeping with your wife, you went out on a giant excursion with some, you know, you went to Argentina. Yeah. People can stay through that. But this is like, this is embezzlement.
Yeah.
This is misuse of funds, and that's not okay.
Yeah, so we'll see what happens with him. Hopefully that seat will turn blue later this year. Next, I want to talk about a Fox News poll. Fox News has been doing some great polling recently. So one result, do you favor or oppose Medicare for all? 46% say they favor it, 31% oppose, 23% don't know, and wait until they find out that it's going to make things cheaper for them and their families, and they'll actually have health insurance. That might swing them a little bit. By the way, even a greater majority saying that healthcare is in fact the responsibility of the American government. And if that is the case, and if you have people actually making the case, I mean, where does that end up? Obviously, that ends up with increasing numbers for programs like Medicare for All. And Reuters also did some polling on Medicare for All, and they found that overall, just 20% of the country opposes a Medicare for All type program. That is amazing.
Yeah, and now it becomes a messaging fight. whether you can effectively communicate that to people. And I do think, and this is not just biased because I work here, I do think that the Justice Democrats have done the best job of essentially saying, some of them have said, I'm not even going to mention Trump. I'm just going to talk about things I feel passionately about that resonate with people. Taking these kinds of poll numbers as opposed to like, do you approve or disapprove of Donald Trump? And running with those poll numbers to craft a message to get people to follow them.
Yeah. Okay, I want to turn now to Elizabeth Warren. I apologize in advance, Brett. I'm going to be reading quite a bit here because I want you to know the breadth and the specificity that this bill goes into in attempting to fight the obviously pervasive corruption that is leading to things like Duncan Hunter's problems with campaign finance, obviously Donald Trump as well, a number of people. So she has this set of reforms. And she's doing this because, as she points out, percentage of the population that trusts government to do the right thing since 1958 to now has dropped from 37% to 18%. So here are the things that her bill would do. It would institute a lifetime ban on the president, vice president, cabinet members, and congressional lawmakers becoming lobbyists after they leave office. That is gigantic. Now, for some of those, there's a couple of years or something like that that you have to wait. So you bide your time and then you make millions of dollars by providing access to people who are still in government, all that stuff. A lifetime ban is gigantic.
Yeah, she was on Rebel HQ recently.
Exactly.
Outlining all the different things. And
well, why don't we go to her? We'll go to some audio of Elizabeth Warren making that case.
Padlock the revolving door. These folks serve on Wall Street. They get big salaries. And then they just pass their way through over to government, where they actually regulate exactly the same folks that they used to work for and will probably work for again. Stop the self-dealing by public officials. If you are a public official, like a senator or maybe the head of one of these agencies, you should not own individual stocks in lobbying as we know it. And that means lobbyists can't make contributions to elected officials. The definition of lobbyist, if you're actually getting paid to go influence our federal government, then by golly, you got to register as a lobbyist. No more Swiss cheese, hide behind maybe this piece and maybe that piece.
So there, that's a good broad brush of some of the changes. I mean, lifetime bans on becoming a lobbyist, stopping congressmen from owning individual stocks. Obviously, they could still, you know, invest in mutual funds, things like that, where they don't have as much specific control over which stocks they own, things like that. Those are gigantic and not things that get discussed, really.
Yeah, so then what happens? Yes, that is one of the initiatives, which is to get money out of politics. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't just mean other things that are involved in that, which is not receiving contributions monetarily from giant specific interests, but also not having a vested interest in the success or failure of any given stock, which translates, I mean, intuitively to stopping these politicians from saying like, oh, I have the orange lobby paying me a lot of money, so I'm going to do everything I can to benefit oranges. Yeah. What that should translate to is maybe if you live in a district that has a giant interest in having the production of oranges be successful, you represent the interests of your constituents in that area.
Yeah.
And that should win out for everyone.
Yeah. Yeah, this is just so, I mean, look, obviously some people want to get involved in government and that's great. I think more people should do it. That's one of the great things about this series of midterms, that more and more people are doing that for the first time. And if you want to enter government because you care about government, you want to see it improved, you have some sort of expertise in a particular area of public policy, an understanding of the Constitution or economics, healthcare, something like that, the tech sector, whatever, get involved in government and do your part to make the country better. But if you want to get into government to enrich yourself, your family, or your friends, screw you, government's not for you. And we don't need you there. We do not require your services. And some sort of two-year ban on lobbying, something like that, that's obviously not enough. People leave government and then they make millions going to work for banks and pharma and oil companies and all of that. They have done very well for themselves for literally hundreds of years. Enough is enough. Elizabeth Warren's plan makes all the sense in the world.
So what politicians disappear? What does the average politician start to look like when you
hopefully
take money
more like
politics?
A regular person and not exclusively Harvard and Yale educated lawyers?
But an average person can't run a major Fortune 500 company, and so the business interests would not win out after that.
That's a risk I'm willing to take. By the way, it also requires people who run for president to make their tax returns public by law. And in case you might think that she's being hypocritical or something, she has now given forth 10 years of her tax returns as well. So a lot of great information from Elizabeth Warren. Hopefully it will go somewhere.
And check out the Rebel HQ interview at youtube.com/RebelHQ.
Exactly, for much, much more from her. Okay, we are going to take our first break. When we come back, we'll be joined by David K. Johnson to break down Donald Trump's legal situation. What is he protected from? What is he not protected from after this?
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today, and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
So Donald Trump has every reason to be anxious about what's gone on so far this week in both Paul Manafort and Michael Cohen pleading guilty to 16 combined counts, and Michael Cohen, who's been very tightly connected with Donald Trump for some time, directly implicating the president in multiple crimes. But at the same time, Donald Trump is, by Department of Justice sort of tradition, insulated from a lot of potential accountability at the federal level. But is he so protected at the state level? To discuss this, we're joined once again on the Damage Report by David K. Johnson, investigative journalist. Welcome to the show, David.
Well, glad to be here.
It's good to have you back. So before we get to what can actually be done, I wanted your opinion, since you've been following this in detail for years. You've been following Donald Trump for longer than the vast majority of other journalists.
Oh, longer than any other person, 30 years.
Longer than anyone. Longer than anyone really should.
That's probably also quite true.
Yes. So did we learn anything fundamentally new on Tuesday, or was this mostly just confirmation of crimes that we've believed for months or longer took place?
Oh, no, I think we learned a great deal that's new. And it's important to understand that the Justice Department prosecutors do not allow you to enter into a plea agreement unless they believe the facts that you are pleading to or allocuting to, which is what he did in court, are true. Mm-hmm. So what we know that's true now is that, at least in the belief of the Justice Department prosecutors, that Donald Trump directed these hush money payments, that these payments were run through the Trump Organization. So when Donald Trump goes on Fox and says, "There's no crime here, there's no crime, you know, it's my personal money, and I didn't know about it until afterwards," all of those are lies. These are felony crimes under federal law, and that's new. Secondly, there's a tantalizing little pair of details about the payments the Trump Organization made to Michael Cohen. We did know that Cohen had sought reimbursement of $130,000 payoff to Stormy Daniels, 45% of which, by the way, went to her lawyer, who may well have been working in league with Trump rather than representing Ms. Daniels. Well, he got back $360,000. Now, why would you pay someone more than twice what it was they billed you for? I just sort of wonder what might motivate that. Secondly, there's an item in there of a $50,000 reimbursement for, during the campaign, technical services. We'll have to wait a little while to find out, but don't be surprised if that turns out to be payments to a hacker. Mm-hmm.
That is certainly a possibility. Maybe some 300-pound hacker in his basement, as Donald Trump would put it.
In his basement, or maybe a Russian agent in St. Petersburg.
Perhaps. So in terms of what can actually be done, the Department of Justice, many people say that the policy is that the DOJ will not allow for the federal indictment of a sitting president. But you've written recently about the possibility of various forms of state-level action against the president. How would that actually play out?
Well, first let's deal with the Justice Department rule. After Watergate, different administrations looked at this and concluded that the problem with indicting a president is it's a unitary executive, and basically the president would be indicting himself. I think that's a nonsense argument, but that is the policy of our federal government at the moment. So on June 15th, DC Report, my nonprofit, non-advertising news service, began a campaign to get people to pressure the state of New York to undertake a criminal investigation of the Trump Foundation and its trustees and officers, Donald Trump, his three older children, the CFO of the Trump Organization, who we now know didn't even know he was an officer of the foundation for the years when Trump was using it as a personal cookie jar. The Foundation's abuses and disregard for federal law that limits where you can spend charitable dollars create tax issues for Donald Trump. New York tax law is essentially, New York tax reporting is essentially identical to the federal government unless you're a retiree. So every time the Trump Foundation paid a lawsuit settlement on behalf of Trump, bought portraits that hang in Trump properties, bought the Tim Tebow helmet, made the illegal campaign contribution to the attorney general candidate who was reelected in Florida, who shut down her investigation of Donald Trump's corrupt Trump University. That was income to Donald Trump. And if he didn't report those and other payments as income, he has committed tax crimes. Now, the attorney general of New York only has inherent civil authority, but she acquires criminal investigative powers if the governor, the state police, or the State Department of Taxation make a criminal referral to her. So at DC Report on June 15th and then July 5th in the New York Times in an op-ed, I urged people to call the governor's office. The governor came around in a little bit of a weaselly way, but basically made it clear he was open to a criminal investigation. And we now know that there is a criminal investigation underway. Michael Cohen was served with a subpoena by the State Department of Taxation and Finance, and he immediately called them and said, hey, what can I tell you? When do you want to meet? Let's get together. So this is very important, because if Trump does shut down the Mueller investigation or pardons people who are indicted by Mueller and his team, he has no power to interfere with the state investigations. And if Donald Trump has committed felonies, he's like any one of the rest of us. We shouldn't cower before someone with power, and we shouldn't hesitate to arrest, to indict, arrest, prosecute, and if found guilty, imprison any felon.
Well, that is certainly interesting information. I don't think a lot of people are particularly well versed on the different possibilities, federal versus state. And so perhaps we'll see that play out, especially with, as you said, the Trump Foundation, Michael Cohen information coming out yesterday. I have one more question for you. We only have a few minutes, but based on what you know about Donald Trump, and as you said, you've been following him for literally decades, with the situation that he's in right now and information being leaked from people who know him saying that he is feeling the anxiety, how do you think he's likely to react in the near future?
Donald has become increasingly erratic, as I predicted he would since he became president, because he's totally and completely unqualified. Donald is delusional. He literally believes, and he's been saying this for 30 years I've known him, you know, that he is superior to the rest of us. I mean, in fact, he calls anybody who disagrees with him an idiot or a fool or stupid, particularly people of color. And now that Donald is seeing that there's a tightening vice around him and more people are going to abandon him because his whole system is run on a mob mentality of loyalty to the boss, I think that Donald is going to behave even more erratically. I think this is a very dangerous time for the country. And it is particularly dangerous because the leading Republicans on Capitol Hill are trying every which way they can to continue protecting Donald Trump instead of fulfilling their constitutional duties of oversight and investigation.
And I would certainly predict that that will continue.
Probably.
Yeah. David K. Johnson, thank you for joining the show once again and then lending your expertise.
Thank you.
Thank you. We are going to take a short break. When we come back, the flailing of Donald Trump that was just predicted has actually begun. We'll be going to some video from Fox and Friends, interesting legal theories from the president after this. Welcome back to the Damage Report, everybody. I'm John Adirola. Brett Ehrlich joins me in studio, host of Pop Trigger. Happy half hour. Hopefully this will be a happy week for you. It's been happy for some people around the country, not the White House so much.
Yeah, no, bad for them. Happy half hour. Watch it 1:30 p.m. Friday Pacific and 4:30 p.m. Eastern. We have Christine Schieffer from And That's Why We Drink, a podcast that talks about paranormal activity and also talks about true crime. It is like a two-hander. One talks about paranormal and she talks about true crime. If you're drinking gin fizzes, you're going to love it.
Yes. By the way, I've mentioned this earlier, but if you don't already know, we have both an audio podcast network on TYT and the TYT Plus app is available on both iTunes and Android right now. You can download that and get access to not only all of the content for the Damage Report, but the Happy Half Hour as well, and a ton of other great shows too. We turn now to updates on Michael Cohen and some of the other people sort of circling in his legal orbit. And first is David Pecker, chairman of American Media Inc. Don't laugh. So his name was brought up on Tuesday in conjunction with the payments that were made to Hush women that alleged that they had affairs with the president. So he is the publisher, by the way, of the National Enquirer, which is perhaps the only media outlet more supportive of the president than Fox and Friends. So he has apparently provided prosecutors with details about those payments that Mr. Cohen arranged with women who alleged those sexual encounters with Donald Trump, including, by the way, Mr. Trump's knowledge of the deal. So again, this is a guy who is a hard and fast supporter and defender of the president who might be in legal trouble of his own. And so he is, according to these reports, apparently working with prosecutors and can show that Donald Trump, that not only did these payments happen, but the most important part is, did Donald Trump know about it? And now multiple people involved with them apparently have evidence that he did.
And this just tests the borders of everyone's self-illusion. That's what it is. Because I think a lot of folks, when you do commit crime, when you do sketchy stuff like this, even if it's not a crime, if you're the head of the National Enquirer and you're helping to like make stories disappear, you have this illusion that you're kind of above the law. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like Michael Cohen and Mr. Pecker, sorry, it's a Ghostbusters thing, but Mr. Pecker, God, I love saying that. Mr. Pecker, they both got to the boundaries of their ability to, you know, delude
maintain
themselves
that illusion that
and
no
feel like they're above the law. Yep. But someone who refuses to go gently into that good night is Donald Trump, who has maintained that these folks are turning on him. Mm-hmm. But
yeah,
he's,
so we're gonna
no
have
matter
all-
how much, yeah. No matter how much evidence there is to the contrary, he is going to stand true to it. But in this situation, it looks like Mr. Pecker.
That's his name.
What was his dad's last name?
I don't remember.
Dr. Pecker?
Thankfully, in this particular case, it isn't up to Donald Trump to determine whether he's guilty or not. So now, to be fair, on Wednesday, Donald Trump, I almost called him Dr. Trump. He is certainly not qualified to be a doctor. Denied that he directed Mr. Cohen to participate in those payments. Now, this contradicts earlier statements where he has basically admitted to it, or that he became aware later on, or we also have the audio type that Omarosa released, which made clear that he knew about it beforehand. It's interesting that you can simply go and say, I didn't know about it, when we have you on tape already saying that you knew about it. But that, again, is the world we live in. That should be the name of the show at this point. It's just the world we live in.
Deal with it. It's just terrible.
But what's interesting is that David Pecker is not the only potential new face to enter into this story. Two senior Trump Organization executives had involvement in the financial arrangements, according to the court filing from earlier this week. Separately, one or more members of the 2016 Trump campaign were cited as having worked to identify other stories about Mr. Trump's romantic entanglements, quote, so they could be purchased and their publication avoided, which means that we might not even be at the end of these sorts of hush money payments to individuals or coordination with outlets like the National Enquirer, although possibly others, to purchase these stories, which again, if this is information, financial information that is not disclosed, those are campaign finance violations and thus federal crimes. Despite what you might hear on Fox about whether crimes are crimes, with Ainsley Earnhardt, of Fox News saying, is breaking campaign finance laws actually illegal? Is that a crime? I looked into it. It is.
It is. And the argument is, it's like everybody does it, eventually you remedy it, but there's a difference between the way campaign finance violations that you see go down. Mm-hmm. The normal kind of campaign finance violation is you failed to report.
Yes.
Normal things like donations when they came in, maybe some of those donations are too big. But in this situation, it was to get rid of, it was hush money payments. Mm-hmm. And that is more nefarious. And of course, there's certainly, we have different degrees of murder. We have different degrees of campaign finance violations.
Yeah.
And you have people like Alan Dershowitz. It wasn't just on Fox. He goes on CNN and says the same thing. It's a kind of a ticket. Mm-hmm. I know, but this is way different. There's a piece in the New York Times, I think today, about they went back and looked at how the framers looked at impeachment. The framers of the Constitution, and George Mason was like, we have to make it so that if someone undertakes corrupt acts to secure the presidency, mm-hmm. we have to be able to impeach him in that situation.
Yeah. Now, specifically sort of cited this sort of situation.
Right. And yeah. that was a framer's intention. Now, that was more like bribing members of the Electoral College to mm-hmm. do that. But still, this was bribing someone essentially to keep something quiet, going around the regulations that we have in order to make those kinds of things public.
Yeah. You know, it occurs to me, at one point we were worried about, well, I wasn't, but he was worried about a brokered convention with the Republican National Convention.
Yeah.
They might want to look into any sort of weird financial transactions. Anyway, listen, no evidence of that.
Hillary still lost. It's a bad thing. But
yes, that's true.
It was because the system itself contradicted the popular vote. Went against the popular.
Yeah. Okay, so look, that's Michael Cohen and all of them. Let's turn now to Donald Trump, because the question really is, what is he going to do now? That's what we were talking about with David K. Johnston. Well, I can say that his tweet storm of the morning, which is a normal thing now, started early, actually, at 1 a.m. Eastern time. Donald Trump tweeted, no collusion, rigged witch hunt. And there is no way that that did not come about. Come back to me. That did not come back as a result of him waking up. That is the only way. So that's how he started the morning at 1 a.m.
I would love to see Donald Trump's predictive text at this point. It's mm-hmm. just like, you know how it tells you what your next line's probably going to be? It's always like, no collusion, rigged, witch hunt. He just taps across.
Yeah, yeah. It's an efficient social media system. So that's what he started with. But then he had an interview with Fox and Friends that was aired today. We already talked about Ainsley Earnhardt being confused about whether breaking laws is a crime or whether committing crimes is breaking the law. I don't know which. But he said a lot of interesting things here. So the first, and this is one of the most Trumpy statement possible, I give myself an A+. I don't think any president has ever done what I have done. Is there anything he has not given himself an A+ on? Man, he is a self-satisfied individual. It is just great to have completely unjustified confidence in everything you've ever done.
It's so ridiculous.
By the way, that's if he makes
his report cards out. It's like, you know, attitude, A+. Mm-hmm. Economy, A+.
Humility, A+.
Humility, and then prints it out and mails it to himself. And then goes to the mailbox and I'm, my report card's in.
Yeah.
All A+'s again.
It's coming up, Donnie. So look, that's just having a little bit of fun. But then we get into areas where it might be predictive of something that he's going to do. So he also said this, if I ever got impeached, I think the market would crash. I think everybody would be very poor. Because without this thinking, you would see numbers that you wouldn't believe in reverse, Trump said, pointing at his head.
Yeah, there's video of certain things he said.
Yeah, so we're gonna get to the video in just a second. But he said, everybody would be very poor. So it's not that he doesn't think he should go down for the crimes that he's committed. He's just worried about you and your economic situation. He doesn't want you to be poor. I don't buy it. I don't really buy it.
Yes.
He also, by the way, said, and this might have been one of the most predicted things once Michael Cohen stood in court and said he was involved in these crimes. He said that Michael Cohen, quote, worked more or less as a part-time employee. He was a lawyer for me, one of many. Didn't do big deals, did small deals. No, he was your fixer. He was the guy who was going to take a bullet for you. You've known him for forever. He did not make coffee for you. He was not an intern. He was your lawyer. By the way, he has three clients. If he's only working part-time for you, what the hell is he doing all day long?
Medallions,
that's true.
He's doing medallions. I love that. It's just so sad. It's just, do you even have to go back in time and find the actual tweets that he made saying, this is a great guy, perfect guy, hired him, fantastic.
Yeah, I guess we could have done it. Feel free if you need to, you know that they're out there. Okay, but we do have Donald Trump. He gets into a few interesting little quotes that we've got for you here. Let's listen.
76 days away from the midterms, hard to believe. If the Democrats take back power, do you believe they will try to impeach you?
Well, you know, I guess it says something like high crimes and all. I don't know how you can impeach somebody who's done a great job. I'll tell you what, if I ever got impeached, I think the market would crash. I think everybody would be very poor. Because without this thinking, you would see numbers that you wouldn't believe.
Well, he brings up a great point. Can you actually impeach a president who is doing a good job by his own estimation? I have looked into it. Yes, you can. That's settled. It was a good question, but it's settled.
Yes, you absolutely can.
Of course you can. It doesn't make any sense. It has nothing to do with it. By the way,
just I think we're glossing over that. Mm-hmm. How ridiculous a statement that was. Before the election, I was talking about like he's just like that fart smell you get used to. Mm-hmm. And like at the beginning, like that's terrible. But then you don't smell it, and that's the scariest part. Like it still smells like fart in here. I just don't smell it. That's Donald Trump. That's that ridiculous statement.
If a past president had ever said that, that is the quote you would remember from Nixon or from Ford or whatever. Can you really impeach a president if he's doing well? He also, by the way, said he thinks that flipping should be illegal.
And not flipping
houses.
Seems
sort of self-interested. No. You can be flipper, you can flip houses, but you can't flip on the president. Anyway, we do have to take another break. But when we come back, we are joined on the Damage Report once again by author Lori Penny, who's going to help us dig a little bit deeper into what is driving some men to follow Jordan Peterson and his odd cult of supposed self-improvement after this. So earlier this week, we were lucky enough to be joined by author Lori Penny. And my goal was for us to finally fix men and all of their problems. And we got close, but we didn't quite do it. So we decided to bring her back on. And I think this time we're going to nail it. Welcome back to the show, Lori.
Hey, Jen. How are you doing?
I'm great and much better now that you're here. So we were talking about Jordan Peterson. And there were a few areas of his work that you've researched and written about that I wanted to get into that we weren't able to with the time that we had. So the first thing I want to ask you about is, obviously, this is not a Jordan Peterson thing, but there's this big, a lot of attention being given to the incel movement online and related issues of men in terms of feelings of entitlement towards women and like that area of not having control of their lives. To what extent, if any, are concerns about dating and sex a part of the appeal of Jordan Peterson?
Honestly, I think concerns about dating and sex, particularly young men, and not only young men, like, but particularly young men's sort of frantic, anxious feelings about sexual entitlement, they don't just explain the appeal of Jordan Peterson, they explain quite a lot about what's wrong with our politics right now, both your politics in the US and, you know, around the world, like in Britain. You know, this idea that, honestly, I don't think you can understand the trend towards neo-nationalism and modern fascism without understanding toxic masculinity. And you can't understand toxic masculinity without understanding this idea that men are somehow entitled to a woman, access to the body of at least one woman, any woman. And, you know, the idea that you're meant to be just given a woman. Can you stop doing that? Sorry, last time I was on here, you just sort of flashed up Jordan Peterson.
We're trying to throw you off your game.
it's like that scene in Fight Club, you know, when they flash it up. I saw it.
It's the cigarette burn.
Yeah. Fight Club is one of their favorite films. They really think it's you know, a model for like these incels. You know, you have to, you know, screw the system and, you know, just take what you want. It's a really, honestly. So
hold on, can I ask you a question about that? Do they not get that that's not the moral lesson of Fight Club? That is what you have to go past to actually learn the lesson of Fight Club?
No, I mean, I honestly, look, there are I thought that everybody knew that Fight Club was a deeply misogynist film, but it turns out that some people don't get it. They think this is an aspirational film. Mm-hmm. But look, you can trace the incel movement, in as much as it is a movement, from the pickup artist community and the men's rights community. And it's really interesting because it's like, you know, just as neoliberalism, right, the markets and, you know, just take what you want and play the game, tracks onto fascism, you know, when the game doesn't work, just force people to give it to you. So the pickup artist movement, you know, just play the game and neg people and chop and then notches on the bedpost and be an alpha male. When that doesn't work, people get resentful and they just start, you know, going into this extreme version of misogyny. Sexual neoliberalism becomes sexual fascism, which is basically what the incel movement is. But I think one thing that's extremely important to remember is that in a lot of these communities, and we've got to understand that the incel community and the neo-nationalist community are deeply, deeply linked. They have been from the start. All of these movements, that are, they deliberately target young men who have mental health problems, and they almost fetishize nihilism and a feeling of being broken and let down by the system. And I really think this isn't being taken seriously enough. You know, the incel movement is a hotbed of recruitment for the far right. I have spent, you know, because this is kind of what I do for a living, I've spent the last 6 months or so intermittently on deep dives down in all of these communities, and it is really, really scary how you can track that. People aren't really, obviously the incel movement is bad enough in itself, right? But the links between that and all kinds of violent extremism, they're not paid attention to, for the obvious reason that we don't think about how young white men are recruited into extremism, because we don't read that as terrorism. We just read that as, oh, these individual crazy lone wolves.
Yeah, even though there seem to be a lot of similarities, obviously in different languages, perhaps on different forums, but there seem to be similarities in terms of how these people are recruited into their ideologies.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And your average white American Christian incel has so much more in common with your young Muslim man being recruited to join ISIS. You know, the brainwashing is really, really similar. And actually some of them are starting to realize it. They're saying, oh, well, you know, obviously, because we're bigots, we don't like, you know, non-white people. But some of these ISIS guys, some of these Muslim extremists, you know, we're not quite sure how we feel about them because we're meant to not like them. But we, you know, they kind of seem to have the right idea about women. Wouldn't it be nice to just be allocated a wife? Actually, when they're in other countries where they're trying the de-radicalization programs, I've spoken to people who told me that one of the ways that some states deal with it, not that this is a good idea, although it's been mooted in the US, is people who are exiting these extremist groups are sort of just allocated a wife. Wow. You know, just give them a wife, that'll sort them out. So I'm not sure if I'm gonna get you.
I don't remember for sure if we mentioned this, but there's Jordan Peterson and his defenders say that the enforced monogamy comments that have been attributed to him are an unfair description of what he thinks about that. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I'm not. As far as I'm aware, the enforced monogamy idea, that's one thing you can't put down to Jordan Peterson. And actually, all of the stuff I've been saying over the past few minutes, it's kind of bad that we've got Jordan Peterson flashed up on the bottom of the screen, because he's not saying this stuff. He's an entry point for young men who then go into darker things. But the commonality is this, you know, targeting and almost in some ways exploiting the young men with mental health problems, young men who are depressed and miserable, which is kind of understandable. You know, most people I know are depressed and anxious. Mm-hmm. I'm depressed and anxious. Are you depressed and anxious? I mean, I feel like people who aren't depressed and anxious aren't paying attention in the world right now.
Perhaps. But great that you point out that, of course, there are gradations of all of this. And we're not attributing all or even most of this to Jordan Peterson necessarily, but we exist in this sort of morass online of these different ideologies, and there's certainly some fluidity between them.
Yeah, that's the upsetting thing.
So look, I would like to have you back on at some point in the near future where perhaps we can talk about where we go from here, some ideas for a more productive way to deal with some of these large and seemingly growing social problems. But for now,
fix toxic masculinity.
I think that we can do it. It might take a couple of videos, but I'm pretty sure we can do it.
All right, thank you, John.
Okay, thank you, Lori Petty. We're going to take one more break. When we come back, a video of a challenger to Ted Cruz has gone viral in Texas. Wait until you see this. Ted Cruz is probably one of the worst people in the country, certainly one of the worst politicians, and he is in a fight for his future in Texas. Maybe. It's still a pretty red state, but he's running against Beto O'Rourke. And Beto O'Rourke has been doing quite well. Polls in recent weeks had him down by about 5 or 6 points, which in Texas for a Democratic Senate challenger is huge. And that would be, if that could happen, that would be a gigantic upset. But recently, Beto O'Rourke went mega viral on the internet for good cause. A video of him talking about the NFL protests is going around. Let's listen.
Peaceful, nonviolent protests, including taking a knee at a football game to point out that black men, unarmed, black teenagers, unarmed, and black children, unarmed, are being killed at a frightening level right now, including by members of law enforcement, without accountability and without justice. And so nonviolently, peacefully, while the eyes of this country are watching these games, they take a knee to bring our attention and our focus to this problem to ensure that we fix it. That is why they are doing it. And I can think of nothing more American than to peacefully stand up or take a knee for your rights anytime, anywhere, any place. So thank you very much for asking the question.
That's how politicians should communicate about that issue. By the way, that video from Now This has been retweeted more than 160,000 times.
And it's important to point out that the question came from someone who seemed to be against the protests.
That's a good point. Thank
you. Who was similarly coming from a place that Beto was also coming from, was like, let's just understand each other. Mm-hmm. And I think if that's your priority, then we can make headway. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people, as we see in increasingly tribal society, that's not their priority whatsoever. Yeah. They feel like what they want to do is score points for their side rather than have this interaction. And as everyone points out from the get-go, the whole reason that kneeling was settled on as the way to protest was after a discussion that Kaepernick and Eric Reid had with a Green Beret. Mm-hmm. To say, like, what should we do? And the Green Beret was like, kneeling is more respectful. People do it. Soldiers do it. So it's so frustrating when people come at it from a biased perspective.
Yeah, or after all of this time, still asserting that it isn't really about that. They're lying about what it's about. They can say that it's about a lack of justice in this particular area for this community, but they're lying. They're doing it because they hate cops, or they're doing it because they hate the military, or they hate Trump, or they hate all white people, or whatever. Like, there have been really complex, broad social movements that it is difficult to assert exactly what they're for. Like the Tea Party, a lot of it was about the deficit and debt, but it was about a lot of different things. A lot of different people being supported by a lot of different organizations. You can assert various motives to different parts of that. But they have been incredibly specific from the very beginning about what this protest is about. It's a specific group of people doing it in a very specific way. To assert at this point that you don't understand that or that they're lying, there is nothing other than racial animus and racial bias that can lead to that. And yet we see it every day. And by the way, if you want a contrast between Beto O'Rourke, his understanding and communication about this issue, and some other people in Texas, well, this is from 2 years ago almost. Ted Cruz tweeted, "Here's a peaceful protest. Never buy another shoe, shirt, or jersey of rich, spoiled athletes who dishonor our flag."
That was in response to Jalen Rose, who tweeted, "Salute to all NFL players."
Yeah.
Jalen Rose, a basketball player and commentator now.
So they're not dishonoring the flag. It's incredibly clear about that. Rich and spoiled, some of them literally lost their careers because of this. There's nothing more, the exact opposite of spoiled, than being willing to give up your economic future to make this case to help out other people who don't have cameras on them.
It's dishonest and disingenuous from the point of view of Ted Cruz, and it's obvious. It's so clear to me that all he's trying to do is score points with his base that he needs in order to beat Beto O'Rourke.
Yeah. And look, maybe it'll work. We know that when Donald Trump gets in trouble, he inevitably talks about the NFL. I'm surprised he hasn't done that yet this week.
He did talk about the spineless ESPN and how they won't televise the anthem ceremony.
Jesus. Okay. Well, look, maybe it'll work, maybe it won't, because the most recent poll that I just saw on CNN literally this morning was Democrat Beto O'Rourke pulls within 4 points of Ted Cruz in Texas. I believe that that polling is before this video went out, so we don't know what effect it might have. But if Ted Cruz went down,
I would love it.
That is justice.
So good.
That is justice. And so hopefully we'll see that.
I like Beto O'Rourke because his name sounds like it was randomly generated by a computer.
That's an Irish computer.
Yep.
Well, thank you, Brett, for joining me. You can tune in tomorrow, 1:30 p.m. Pacific time for another episode of his show. Thank you for watching. We'll be back tomorrow. Francesca Fiorentini joins us on the show. Lots for you. To hear even more about both this topic and other issues not being covered nearly enough by the mainstream media, you're going to want to tune in every morning to our full hour-long show. That's at 12 p.m. Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific, available on the TYT Network channel on YouTube TV.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.